Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Dalet Amud Aleph. The Gemara here is continuing to discuss what we left off with yesterday, which is be motzi diba huksil, the one who is bearer of bad tidings of rumors of news is a fool. That we don't want to present the negative tidings, the bad news, and we do it in a circumspect way. So we have another story that indicates that similar type of sentiment, which is Rav Baruchua de Rabbi Chia ubarachte. Rav was related to Rabbi Chia from both sides of his parents. Rabbi Chia was his uncle from his father's side, and he was his uncle from his mother's side. Rabbi Chia was his father's brother, as well as his mother's brother. Now obviously it couldn't be that they were all brothers and sisters, otherwise Rav's parents could not have gotten married because they were brothers and sisters. But rather, Rav's father, Aibo, was Rabbi Chia's brother through their father. They shared a common father, Rav Acha Mikafri. On the other hand, his mother, Ema, was Rabbi Chia's sister through a common mother. So actually, Rav's parents were step-siblings. Aibo and Rabbi Chia were brothers through a common father. Rabbi Chia and Ema, Rav's mother, were brother and sister through a common mother. And then those that father and mother married, so that made them step-siblings. Okay, Yisalik da Hatam. When Rav came to Eretz Yisrael, Rav was in Bavel, he was Ode Le Eretz Yisrael, he learned by Rabbi Chia and he learned by Rabbi, and then eventually returns to Bavel, becomes one of the leaders of the community in Bavel. When he reached to Eretz Yisrael, Rabbi Chia Amarle, Rabbi Chia says to him, now there are three different ways to read this Gemara. I'll read it first according to the way Rashi reads it, which is Aibo Kayam. He's asking him, is your father alive? Meaning Rabbi Chia is asking, is his brother still alive? So he responds back to him, Amalei, Ema Gayamet? Why don't you ask me about Ema, his sister? Why don't you ask him about her? Amalei, Ema Gayamet? He says, is my sister Ema, your mother, still alive? Amalei, Aibo Kayam. He says, wait a minute, you didn't still ask me about my father or about your brother. Rav was being, again, circumspect. He wasn't answering him directly with regards to this. And so Rabbi Chia understood from this that Rav was trying to indicate to him that both his mother and father had passed away. Rav's mother, Ema, and Rav's father, Aibo, had passed away, who were both brother and sister to Rabbi Chia. That's the way Rashi reads the Gemara, because of problems in the other Girsot. The other Girsa that starts it is Rabbeinu Chananu. You can see in the Rabbeinu Chananu. Rabbeinu Chananu says that Rabbi Chia actually was asking about himself. Amalei Abba Kayam. Amar Avi Chai. Rabbi Chia asked, Rav, is my father alive? Meaning, Rav Acha Mikafri, is he alive? Rav's grandfather, is he still alive? So Rav says back to them, Abba Sheli Chai. My father is alive. Amalo. So then Rabbi Chia says, is my mother alive? Referring to Rav's grandmother. And Rav says back to him that my mother is alive. So by doing that, Rav was, again, in a circumspect way, telling him that my father and mother are alive, but your mother and father are not alive. That's the way Rabbeinu Chananu reads it. Now, the Girsa in Rabbeinu Chananu is slightly different, but the way that we have the Girsa in our Gemaras, Tosafot takes a combination of the Girsa of our Gemara and the Rabbeinu Chananu, and Tosafot says that the question that Rabbi Chia was posing was about his parents, meaning Rav's grandparents, but Rav's response was not like the Rabbeinu Chananu says, which is, Rabbeinu Chananu says that he asked him about his grandfather, and Rav responded about his own father, and then he asked him about his grandmother, and Rav responded about his own mother, but rather what we have in our Gemara, which is that Rav answered him that my mother is still alive, not as a question, but rather as a statement. Rabbi Chia said, is my father alive? And Rav says, my mother is alive. And then Rabbi Chia asked him about his mother, meaning that Rav's grandmother, and Rav responds that his father, Rav's own father, Rabbi Chia's brother, is alive. And the reason that he did not answer him in concert, like the Rabbeinu Chananu says, which is when Rabbi Chia said to him, is my father alive, your grandfather alive, and Rav would have responded like the Rabbeinu Chananu says, yes, my father is alive. Sometimes people use the word Abba to refer to a grandfather. So in order to avoid that confusion, Rav didn't say, yes, my father, your brother is alive, because he might have thought that referred to his grandfather or Rabbi Chia's father. So because of that, he has this change in the Girsa. Rashi doesn't like the way the Rabbeinu Chananu sets it up, because Yeshomim b'nichuta ava mishivo Rav, that Rav was answering it as not as a question, lashon sheila, rather as a tshuva, because Rashi thinks that the question was posed about Rav's parents. So he said to him, is your father alive? To Rav, my brother, is he alive? And Rav responds to him, my mother's alive. And then he comes back and he says, is your mother alive? My sister, is she alive? And Rav responds that my father's alive. Even though that's not the truth, neither of them were alive. And that's why Rashi rejects that understanding. But if you look in the Rabbeinu Chananel or in the Tosafot, they say that the question being posed was not about Rav's own parents, but about Rav Chiya's parents. And that's why it works within the Gemara that we have without running into the problem that Rashi says that Rav would have spoken untruth. Because Rashi thinks that it's Rav's question relates to, that Rabbi Chiya's question relates to Rav's own parents, whereas Rabbeinu Chananel and the Tosafot think that Rabbi Chiya's questions relate to his parents or to Rav's grandparents. So those are three different ways to read the Gemara. Either the question is about Rav's own parents, and Rav responds in both cases that they have passed away through that circumspect manner by saying in a Lashon of Tema, you asked me about my father, why don't you ask me about my mother? You asked about my mother, why don't you ask me about my father? That's the way Rashi reads it. According to Tosafot and Rabbeinu Chananel, Rabbi Chiya is asking about his own parents, Rav's grandparents. According to the Rabbeinu Chananel, he answers him in concert, which is, after he asks about his grandfather, Rav says, my father's alive. And after he asks him about his grandmother, Rav says, my mother's alive. And Tosafot says it's the opposite, which is that after he asks him about Rabbi Chiya's father, Rav's grandfather, he said, my mother's alive. And then after he asks about his grandmother, or Rabbi Chiya's mother, he says back to him, no, my father is alive, in order to not have any confusion. But again, in both instances, or all three of these instances, the point being that he answers him in a way that he gets the message, which is that they're not alive. And then what does he do? Amalei the Shamei, he says to his Shamish, the one who's helping him, to his servant, Chalutz li min alai, first of all, take off my shoes. Valich kalai acharai lebeit amirchatz, then take my clothing or my shoes after me to the bathhouse. Shema mina talai. From this we can conclude three things about the Beilut. Shema mina, first of all, avel asur benilat asandah. Navel could not wear shoes. That's why Rabbi Chiya removed his shoes, because he's a Navel and he has to remove his shoes. Shmamina, Shmiya Ruchokai, Nunaheged Eliyom Echad. Second piece of information that we garner from this action of Rabbi Chiya is that if you have a Shmiya Ruchokai, Shmiya Ruchokai comes when a person gets news of the passing of a relative that they would have otherwise have to be Mitabelahem. One of the seven relatives where a person is obligated to sit Shiva or to perform a Velut. If they find out the information more than 30 days after the passing of that individual, if they find out about it within the first 30 days of that passing individual, then they will have to sit Shiva like they would in any other instance when they get the news. But then after 30 days, what's called a Shmua Rechoka, it's a more distant piece of information, more distant news. At that point, the Gemara says what Rabbi Chiya teaches us over here is that when you get information about a passing of a relative that you otherwise would be mitabelam, then you only have to sit Shiva, or you only have any vilut for a single day. Shema Minah, the third thing we learn from this is Mikta Tayom Kekulo. It's a principle in Avilut that part of the day is considered to be the whole day. So over here, Rabbi Chiya takes off his shoes, he has some Avilut, but he's going to the bathhouse, and he's going to end his Avilut very shortly afterwards. The reason being that he only has to have Avilut for a day, and since Mikta Tayom Kekulo, a partial part of a day, is considered to be a whole day, that is sufficient, and that's all he needs over here. Haudamar Dono Dini. This person who will always, in any business transaction or any other altercation, will always say, let's go to the judge. Let's hear what the judge has to say about this. That he only listened to something that was adjudicated in court or only listened to judges. Amrei Shvamina Midan Kaate. This is a sign that this individual came from Dan. Dichtiv, Dan Yadinamo, Kechad Shifte Israel. So we see in the bracha that Yaakov gives to Dan that Din is associated with the name of Dan and with the bracha of Dan. And therefore, this individual who constantly wanted to be with the Dayanim, only listened to Dayanim, is an indication that he probably is from Shevet Dan. How Dava Gazil Vamar, there was this individual who used to say, Akef Yama Asisne Birato. So the two possibilities Rashi brings down the interpretation of this is, on the banks of the ocean, Asisne Birato, I want to build my hovel, I want to build my palace. And he always wanted to live on the coastline. And that's one interpretation of it. Or the other interpretation is, Akef Yama Sisne, when he used to see the bushes or the thorns on the coastline, Birata, he would say that they were really pines, or these large trees. And he says the bushes on the coastline are the equivalent of pines everywhere else. So it's clear that he had an affinity for the coastline and for the water. So the Badku, they checked after him, Vashkuchu, the Mizvulun, that he came from Shevet Zvulun, Dichtiv, Zvulun, the Chof Yamim, Mishkon, based on the bracha that Yaakov gives to Zvulun, that he will be a seafarer. So this person was from the Shevet of Zvulun, and therefore he demonstrated those character traits of loving the ocean or loving being on the coastline. Bahashta, now the Gemara goes back to the discussion that we had before about or tohu. Just hashta the kaimalandu kuli alma, now that we agreed, according to everyone, that or tohu, that or means at nighttime, michte. Ben the Rabbi Huda, Ben the Rabbi Meir. Whether it's Rabbi Huda or Rabbi Meir, that will be a Mishnah upcoming on the Perek, where Rabbi Huda and Rabbi Meir argue about the extension of the hours of Isur Chametz on Erev Pesach, how much the Chachamim extended that, or how much did they add on to the Isur Doraita. But both of them agree, Chametz Eino Asur Ela Mishesho Dulamala. Everybody agrees that Chametz is only Asur from the sixth hour and onward. So the Gemara says, V'nibdok B'shit. So why don't we do B'dika on the sixth hour of the day? Why did you do B'dika at Chametz the night before, if the Isur Chametz Midoraita starts at the beginning of the seventh hour, and the Rabbanan, the Isur starts in the beginning of the sixth hour? So let's do B'dika right around then. Why are we doing B'dika much earlier on the night before? If you want to suggest Zrizim Makdimin the Mitzvot, that a person who is Zariz, a person who is fastidious and wants to get the Mitzvah done in a timely fashion, so he does it as early as possible. So he should get up early and wants to do it early, so he does it the night before, because that's the first moment that he has a chance to do it. When it says, Nivdok Mitzvah Afro, then he should do it in the morning. Zvizim Makdim in the Mitzvot would not take you back to the previous night, it would only take you to the earliest point in the morning, Dichtiv. Because we know by the Gabei Milah, it says, V'yom HaShmini Imom B'sar Aloto, boy gets a Brit on the eighth day of his life, and it says, U'bayom, during the day or the eighth day. V'tanya, and we have a bright about that, Kol Yom Hulo Kasher LeMilah. The entire day is kasher for milah because it says v'yom hashmini. Ela shezvizim makdimin the mitzvot. But we have this principle that zvizim do mitzvot early in the day. Shneamar v'yishkeim Abraham baboker. Abraham got up early in the morning. So different interpretations in different places of v'yishkeim Abraham baboker. Twice the Torah says v'yishkeim Abraham baboker. Once by the Akedat Yitzchak when he gets up early to go to the Akedah. And the other one, in the case where Avram gets up after the destruction of Sodom, he says, there, Vayishkem Avram Baboker. So here we'll go with the interpretation that it refers to the Akedah, and that he got up early in the morning to proceed to the Akedah. And the fact is that he didn't have to get up so early. He could have gotten up at sunrise. He could have gotten up at a time that was a little later. But instead, Vayishkem Avram Baboker, because he wanted to do the mitzvah, he's excited to follow the Shivui Hashem, he gets up early in the morning. So we see this idea of Zvizim, Makdimim Limitzvot. So you see that even if Zvizim Makdimim the Mitzvot applied over here, you'd only do the B'dikah starting from early in the day. Maybe Alot HaShachar, maybe Netzach Chama, but you wouldn't do it from the night before, so how do we end up doing B'dikah the night before? Amar Rav Nachman Yitzchak, the reason is, B'shash Bnei Adam Mitzuyim B'Bateyem. Number one, we do it at a time that people are found in their houses. The B'dikah is about doing a B'dikah, a check of the house itself. So the best time to do a check of the house is when people are actually found inside of the houses. And we'll see this later on in the parak as well, that the light of a candle is good for searching. The best way to search is to use the light of a candle. Today or modern day times, probably to use a flashlight in order to avoid the issues of danger as well as get the better light that come out and you could search with it. But bidika requires something like that because then you can look into the crevices, the small areas, instead of using the light of day, which would not be as effective. So because of those two reasons, we do the B'dika at a time where people are found in the house, and we do it at a time where the candle will be efficient and efficacious at doing the B'dika. From this week we conclude, Hilkach, Haid Suvrin de Rabbanan, this young Talmud Chochom, Lo Liftach Bidnei B'Torta de Tleisa Nagi Abreisar, should not begin his studies, or should not begin to get engrossed in his Chazara of his Torah Shubal Peh, on the 13th, entering into the 14th. Dilma Mashkalesh Mate, because maybe he'll get caught up in his learning. Vatilim Nuyeh be mitzvah, and he won't do the mitzvah in a timely manner, or he won't do it at all. So in order to be focused on the mitzvah itself, we tell the person when it comes to the night of the 14th, even prior to that, at the end of the day of the 13th, we tell him to desist from doing activities that would take him away from doing the mitzvah. That includes sitting down to a meal, that includes sitting down to learn something that is bi'iyun, or something that might draw his attention away. And that's what Abaye is saying over here. Even for learning Torah, we should be careful that on the 13th going to the 14th, the person doesn't get caught up in one of these items because that caused him to not be focused on the mitzvah and do it at the night of the 14th. So now, by me name, Rav Nachman by Yitzchok, they asked this question of Rav Nachman Yitzchok. Maskir bait lechaveiro ba'abarsar. Someone who rents out a house to his friend on the 14th. Ami livdok. Who has the obligation here to do the bidika on the house? Ala maskir livdog? Is it on the landlord to do the bidika? The chamira didayu, because the bread that's found in the house belongs to him. Oh, dilma ala socher livdog. Or maybe it's the renter who has to do the bidika. The isura bishutekai. Because now once he's rented the house, the chametz, which is isur, is in his possession. Now Tosafot points out over here, don't say that because the chametz belongs to the maskir, to the landlord, that that's why he has to do the bdikah, because he's the only one who can do bitul, because he's the only one who has the ability to do bitul on this, and therefore he is chayav livdok, because then it becomes irrelevant that he did on the 14th. Then even if he did on the 13th, you'd have the same question. The question's not about 13th or 14th, it's a question about his ability to do bitul, and his ability to do bitul is the same on the 13th and the 14th. So that can't be the question at hand. Tosafot says the question is like this, or formulate the question like this, that chamira didayu lekach chal av chiyuv bdika. Since the chametz was his, therefore he was obligated to do bdika before he gave it away, before he rented out the place. And so because he had that obligation to do bdika, once it devolves upon him, he cannot relieve himself of that obligation by simply renting it out to another person. He has to then discharge that obligation and not allow for someone else to do it or ask someone else to do it. So the question being here, we have a house that has chametz in it or has yet to have bdika done to it. And we want to know who is the party that is obligated to do bdika. Is it the renter or is it the landlord? Now this happens on the 14th itself. So now, is it because he owned the chametz coming into the 14th, that's his obligation because he now became obligated in bdika to chametz? Or do we say now that the socher, now that he's taken over the house, it's his problem because it's his house, and he's going to be living there, and the bdika is, in a sense, to protect him, and therefore, he's the one that's obligated in it. So Gemara says, let us try to bring a proof from mizuzah. Tashma, a maskir bait l'chavero, person who rents a house out to his friend, ala socher la sodu mizuzah. It's the obligation of the renter to make the mizuzah. So from there, you would conclude that the mitzvah of mizuzah devolves upon the person or the socher that is there, the one who rents it, because it's his house. So let's say the same thing about bdika. If the house belongs to the socher now, then the obligation, the mitzvah of the house will now be the obligation of the socher. So just like by mezuzah, it's the socher that's obligated to put up the mezuzah, so too over here, we should say the same thing, that it's ala socher, that's the bdika. Where it says, hatam, over there by mezuzah, it's a totally different reason. Hamar of misharshia, mezuzah, chuvat adari, that the mezuzah is the obligation of the one who lives there. It has nothing to do with renter or landlord. It simply has to do with the one who is present at the house at the current time. And as Rashi explains, the reason for that is, it's a very simple reason that Rashi gives, because it's protection for the one who lives there. And since it's a protection for the one who lives there, the benefit or the sole benefit is to the one who lives there. And if that's the case, then he should be the one that puts up the mezuzah. If it's protecting him, he should be the one that takes care of it. So over here, it's clear that the socher is the beneficiary of the mitzvah mezuzah. So if he's the beneficiary, he should be the one that's obligated to do it. By chametz, that's not the case. Over here, the bdikat chametz is only midrabanan. Because, as Rashi says, because of bitul ba'al masagi. So over here, you already have Rashi saying that bitul works, and you don't need to have bdikat done, as opposed to what he said in the Mishnah. And this is part of what drives the Ran, as we mentioned before in the Mishnah, to say that Rashi believes, or that the truth is, that bdikat or bitul can accomplish the din d'oraita, but once you've done one of them, the other one becomes d'rabanan. So Rashi says over here, if you've already done bitul, then bdika is simply an obligation mid'rabanan. And our question here is, who is the one that we're going to be mitarech? Who is the one that we're going to obligate to discharge this obligation mid'rabanan? So that's a question here. It's not a question of who's the beneficiary. The beneficiary is done already, because bitul is already done. Once bitul is done, then the chametz is no longer a problem. The bidika now is a secondary wall or a secondary din derabanan to protect against some untoward behavior with the chametz. But in truth, midoraita, you've already taken care of with bitul. So this is a different question. It's not a question of who's the beneficiary. It's a question of who is the obligation or the quote-unquote inconvenience of doing the bidika put upon. So Gemara says, Achamai. So what's the din over here? Amalur of Nachma Yitzhak, Tanina. We have a braita that tells us what the answer is. A maskir by the chaviro. Person rents out for the house to his friend. Imach lo masar lo maftechot. If before he gives him the keys, chala basar, the 14th came in. I mean, the 14th already started before he gave the keys over to the renter. Chala maskir livdok. Then the landlord is the one that must do the bedika. Imach masar lo maftechot. If he already granted the keys or access to the socher before the 14th, then chala basar, al socher livdok. Then it's the obligation of the socher. It's the obligation of the renter. So the way Rashi reads this is that Misirat Maftechot, the giving of the keys, is the consummation of the Kinyan. That finalizes the deal. So the question is, did the deal close before the Chiyuv Bedika or after the Chiyuv Bedika? If the deal closes before the Chiyuv Bedika, then the house belongs to the Socher. If it belongs to the Socher, he's the one obligated to do Bedika. On the other hand, if the deal closes after the Chiyuv Bedika, the Maftechot were given afterwards, Then it's the obligation of the maskir, because at the time of chiyuv, at the time that they entered the day of the 14th, when the chiyuv bedikah starts, it was in possession of the maskir, of the landlord, and therefore he is the one who has to do the bedikah. So Rashi reads it simply as an issue of kinyan. Tosafot does not like that explanation, because we have in the Gemara and Baba Batra and other places that kinyanim with regards to rental is the same for karka. Mesirat maftechot is not one of those items that determines or creates the finality of the kinyan over here. So he doesn't understand why Rashi is saying that that's the pivotal point in the kinyan. But rather, he says it's simply a practical issue, which is mafareshri. Doesn't have to do anything with the kinyan. Even if there's no kinyan, it's whereas the keys in their hand is the obligated party, because whereas the keys has access. And bedika is all about access. You have to be able to get into the house in order to do your bedika. If you lack access, then you can't get into the house, you can't do the bedika. So even if the kinyan is not finalized, if the socher has the keys, then the maskir can't get in there. So you can't demand of the maskir then all of a sudden to be the one who does the bedika. So Rashi says it's very simple. Whereas the keys has access. Whoever has access has got to do the bedika, because otherwise the bedika won't get done. So that's not to do with kinyan, that's to do with simply the practical issue of access to the house. So Bami name Rav Yachman Rav Yitzchak, that is another question that was asked, proposed to Rav Nachman Yitzchak. Maskir by the chavero babasar. Person who rents a house to his friend on the 14th. Cheskato baduk, or in cheskato baduk. Can you assume that bedika was done on this house? When you go to rent it, for instance, you go to a hotel room, and you take a hotel room, you're renting out this hotel room, you come there on the 14th, you take the hotel room, all of a sudden, you want to know, wait, did they do bedika here, or did they not do bedika here? Do you have to do a bedika now, or not? So the mainaf kamino, the Gemara says, well, what's the difference? Lishailit, ask him if he did bedika. You can check, you go to the hotel, you ask them if they did a bedika in the room, or they didn't do a bedika in the room. You can ask that question, you can pose the question to the owner as to whether they did do the bedika or not. Mai says, well, there are cases, the late Lahai Lishule, he's not around, we can't ask him. So the question here is, when we don't have the ability to determine the outcome or the answer, what is the chazaka or what is the status quo of this place? So Gemara says, so do we obligate this individual, do we inconvenience this individual to do the bedika or not? Do we assume that bedika was done and therefore he doesn't have to do it, or we assume no bedika was done and he does have to do it? So I'm a little Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak Tenitua. We already learned this. Everyone is believed with regards to Biur Chometz. Afilu Nashim, even women. Afilu Abadim, even Abadim Knanim. Afilu Ktanim, and even minors. People who are otherwise not Nemanim when it comes to Dinei Edut. Over here, they will be believed with regards to Dinei Edut. And that's what Rashi says over here. That these individuals are believed to testify that there was Bidika done on this area. So their trustworthiness, or they are believed to say that the Balabayit did do Bdika over here. So my time, Mama Hemne, why are they believed? Why are these individuals believed? These individuals don't have Nemanut, they don't have believability in any other context in terms of Edut, while all of a sudden over here, do they have some sort of believability, or are they trusted with regards to these issues? So it must be, La Mishum de Chazkato Baduk, must be because our assumption is that the house was Baduk. That the Chazalka is that a person will not leave their house unchecked, because the mitzvah already came upon them, the obligation came upon them, and a person would not leave the house unchecked. Because Savar HaKol Chavirim, He Meitzel B'dikat Chametz. And the second assumption we're making over here is that everybody is considered to be a Chaver when it comes to B'dikat Chametz. Everybody is considered to be a party, or an individual that cares when it comes to bedikat chametz. Chaver is a terminology that has specific meaning within the Gemara, but chaver, brotherhood, the brotherhood of what? The brotherhood in general means that they were mafrish, trumot, masrot, they were makpid, on tuma and tahara. There are other things the Gemara discusses, exactly what it meant to be a chaver. But that's for areas where those people in particular kept these types of mitzvot. Not everybody's believed by trumot and masrot. Not everybody's believed by tuma and tahara, because it takes a concerted effort to keep those mitzvot and to do them properly. And only people who accepted them or are known to accept them do we believe or assume that they have that chazakah. When it comes to bedikat chametz, since the isur chametz is chamira, is very serious, and everybody takes it seriously, therefore, everybody has a status of chaver. And since everybody has a status of chaver, we assume that no matter whom you're renting this, either this house from or this room from, that they definitely did the bedikat. The obligation was on them, and they definitely discharged that obligation. Titania, because you have a bright, a chaver shemait, a chaver that passed away. Now this is chaver in the classic sense of chaver. And he leaves over a storehouse full of fruits, avilei bnei yoman, even if they were just picked that day or even the previous day. We assume that trumot and masrot were taken off of them because we assume that, and we'll see this in the Gemara on Daf Tet, we'll come back to this chazaka again, which is that we assume that a chaver would never allow any fruits to stay around without him taking off trumot and masrot. Because number one is he wants to do the mitzvah. And number two is he wants to make sure that nobody else gets into trouble because he didn't do the mitzvah. So since he wants to do the mitzvah, so he does, takes off the trumot masrot. Number two is he doesn't want anybody else to eat it without having trumot masrot taken off of it. So because of those two combined issues, we say that for sure he took off trumot masrot. And we'll say the same thing here with regards to the house. We'll assume that the person for certain was bodek the house because everybody's considered to be a chaver and they wouldn't let this mitzvah pass them by. And they wouldn't leave this problem for someone else, and therefore they definitely did bedikat chametz. Mara says, "Umimai, how do you know that's the case?" Maybe the difference in our case is that we have these individuals who are testifying, and they're telling us that it's baduk. But if we didn't have them testify, then that wouldn't be the case. Who says that the house has a chesgad baduk, and that's why they're believed? Maybe the whole reason that it works over here is because they are believed, and they are telling us information. So Mara says, Atu Amir Dahani Mide Mashusha Itpu. Wait a minute. This testimony of these individuals has no bearing. These aren't people who are otherwise nimanim or otherwise have a status of edim. And if that's the case, then just because they say something, they shouldn't change the status or the halachic status of any item. Elamai. So what are you going to suggest here? The Chazkato Baduk? Like you said before, you're going to assume that the house has a chazaka, that it was, that Badika was done to this house? Hi, then the Braita is written in the wrong way. The Braita says, Hakol ne'emanim, everyone is believed. But your way you're formulating it now, it should say, Kol ha'batim b'chazkat b'dukim b'arba'asar mi'bayle. The Braita should not start with the fact that everyone is believed, and that's what seems to be the trigger or the threshold for determining whether it's b'dikah or not. The way you're saying it now, or the way that you're trying to set it up, of chazkat o'baduk, it should have started exactly with that information. The reason that everything works over here is because our assumption is that on the 14th, all houses are b'chizkat b'dika. And that's not what the Braita says, so that's very problematic. Elamai. So Gargo says, okay, so what do you want to suggest now? Mishum amira dahani. It's because of this statement or testimony of these individuals. Halo amrihani. Had these people not said anything low, then it wouldn't work. So tisho mine. So let us come to the opposite conclusion now. That ain't in chizkat obaduk. Because if you say the whole thing is premised on these individuals speaking up, then it means, if they speak up, good. Then you have a chazaka that it's baduk. If they don't speak up, then the opposite is true, and we don't have a chazkat baduk. If that's the case, the status, or the default status of the house is that chazkato ainu baduk. And it's only with the contribution of these individuals testifying that we say that it is baduk. So then the Gemara says, no, we don't have to conclude that. Lo lo mei melecha, I can tell you, chazkato baduk. In the end, it's really chazaka is that it was checked. And that is the default status of a house that has a chazaka that it was checked. The badak. We have the opposite chazaka here. We're certain that this individual did not do bdika over here. He didn't do bdika because we saw him leave. We saw him was engrossed in something else. We saw that something was happening on that day that took his mind off of it. And it was clear that he did not do a bdika. So we're certain he didn't do a bdika. And then these individuals come along and say, but gine, we did check it. We did the bedika. So then, ma'udetema, lo lehem nei rabbanon. Then they say, maybe the rabbanon would not believe them over here to do the bedika. Mashmalon, the conclusion is, kevan de bedika chametz mi de rabbanon, since bedika chametz is only a din de rabbanon. This is Tosfot's big claim against Rashi on the Mishnah, which is here, you see the Gemara clearly says, bedika chametz is only mi de rabbanon, because, mi de oraita bebitu ba'ama sagile. Because min ha-Torah, bitul itself, is sufficient to take care of the problem of chametz. Bidika is only an added thing that we do on top of it, that's not necessarily a necessity. And if that's the case, the Rabbanon imposed bidika. So now, because of that, nu ha-Rabbanon mid-Rabbanon. The Rabbanon who instituted bidika also gave trustworthiness to these individuals. And they said, just like the obligation is mid-Rabbanon, they themselves gave the dispensation to say that these individuals are believed to say that we did the bidika. They're not testifying about somebody else doing the bidika. They are saying they themselves did the bidika. And since it's a derabonon, and a derabonon, the rabbanon said that these people are believed in this case. So a number of things to look at from this. Number one is, from the Gemara, it sounds like these individuals are believed here because it's a din derabonon. But had it been a din d'oraita, they would not be believed. Tosafot raises an issue that we discussed also previously in the Gemara in Eruvin, which is that a person is believed when they have control over the situation. women are believed with regards to kashrut. Women are believed with regards to trumot and masrot. Since it's biyadan, they have the ability to take care of it. And eid echad ne'eman biyisurim, they have a certain amount of ne'emanut here with regards to these items. Eds biyadan, therefore we trust them with these issues. That's even in an issue de'oraita. So if we trust them in issues de'oraita, why is the Gemara over here saying it's only us? The Rabbanan, so we trust them. Even if it's a de'oraita issue, since it's in their capabilities or ability to discharge the obligation, they are believed, just like by kashrut, just like by shchita, just like by chumot and masrot and all other types of items, they have that believability. So Tosafot over here distinguishes between different categories and says that there are certain areas where they're believed. That's in a din d'oraita, where they have control over the situation. In an area where they don't have control over the situation, then they're not believed in a d'oraita and also not believed in the Rabbanan. That's what we saw in Eruvin, that a katan is not believed with regards to the testimony that the Eruv went until this point, or we walked till here on Shabbat. When he becomes a gadol, when he becomes someone who is of age, then he's believed about what he saw when he was a katan. But when he's a katan, he cannot testify because it's lo biadan. He can't make the Eruv, so therefore it's not in his control. He can't testify about it. So that's even in a din d'rabbanan. On the other hand, over here, why wouldn't we believe them? Everybody has it within their control to discharge the obligation. So Tosafot over here says something about bidigat chametz, which is that bidigat chametz is something that's very serious and takes a concerted effort. It takes a lot of effort to do a proper bidigat chametz. We know that today, that it takes a tremendous amount of effort and exertion to do a proper bidigat chametz. If that's the case, we don't necessarily trust individuals who was a din d'oraita. Even individuals who have it in their control, and here we're dealing with the Eved Gani, the Isha, or the Katan, we don't believe that they would have done the proper effort or exertion to discharge the obligation of the Bdikah. And it's only because it's a Din D'Rabbanan do we believe them over here. So that's what Tosafot creates, this other category of items where, even though technically it's within your control, but it's so difficult or it's something that requires so much effort that we wouldn't otherwise believe the individual except for the fact that it is a Din D'Rabbanan. The other thing Tosafot points out over here, which actually has many implications of the halacha, the conclusion from this Gemara is that if you have the ability to ask about something, even when there's a chazakah, we're going to demand of you to ask for that information. And that is, if the person was in the city, then you have to ask them about whether the bidikah was done. Even though you have a chazakah that it's baduk, nevertheless, we're still going to demand of you to go ask them. That means that chazakah is only invoked or utilized when we don't have an ability to check on it. But if we have the ability to check on it, we'd rather check than rely on the chazakah. That's number one. Number two is, how come by trumot masrot, by the chaver, if the chaver gives you something to eat, or the chaver prepares something, we assume that trumot masrot are taken off it, and we don't go and ask him whether he took off trumot masrot. We rely on that chazakah. So why over here do we say that the chazakah requires you to go to ask about it, versus the case by the chaver, by the trumot masrot, we don't require you to go ask and check whether the chazakah is real. We rely on the chazakah even though you could check on it. So he says that there is a mitigating factor by trumot masrot, and that is, kevan sheshalech leulecho, since he's sending the food for him to eat, mistama tikna, then you can assume that he fixed it, shlo yivol lido michshol, that he won't come to a problem. Over there, by trumot masrot, there are two factors that are driving the chaver. One is that he won't let something go out of his hands without the mitzvah being completed. He has the mitzvah, he wants to do it. Number two is, he knows if he doesn't do the mitzvah and sends it to someone else, he'll cause them to be in violation. So there are two things that drive the individual to do the right thing here. One is that he wants to do the mitzvah, and number two is he doesn't want someone else to have a problem because of him. So when you bring those two together, there's a chazakah that's strong enough, they don't even have to ask about it. We can assume that the trumot masrot are taken off. By bidikah, that's not necessarily true. By bidikah, you only have one of those two factors. One is to do the mitzvah. He wants to do the mitzvah, he wants to do the mitzvah right. Michshol, that he's going to cause someone else to have a problem with it, that's not necessarily true by bidikah. Because even if you don't do bidikah, the bittul will hold you over, will take care of the situation, and the bidikah is only an additional fence that we're putting around. So over there, it's not so clear that the person's going to make the concerted effort to make sure that it's done, and we don't have to check on it, because there's this other side to it, which is that you have a way out of the problem even without the bidikah. So because of that, Tosafot says that there are different levels of chazakot. There's certain chazakot where we believe the chazakah stands and you don't even have to check on the chazakah. The chazakah is so strong that you don't even have to ask whether it's true or not true. We assume it to be true. In the other case, there's certain chazakot that have weaknesses in them because you could assume that that's the case if we don't have any other information. But if you have the chance to get the information, we'd rather that you check on it. And that has important halakhic implications, which many of the Rishonim try here and on the Daf Tet, to distinguish and then the halacha understand when is the chazaka foolproof that you don't even have to ask the questions, but when is the chazaka where you have questions on and therefore you're going to have to ask. If you have the chance to ask, we're going to force you to ask and not rely on the chazaka. And therefore the poskim then come up with categories and different ways to divide up chazakot that we find out throughout Shas into a categories that are a chazaka that's so strong you don't even have to ask about it, and a chazakot that we have some questions about, and we're going to ask you if you have the ability to determine whether it's true or not true to ask before you rely on the chazaka. Now the last thing to discuss with regards to the sukkia is that our Gemara says, midoraita bebitul ba'amasagi, that it's enough to do bitul and take care of your problem of tashbitu according to the Gemara. Rashi says tashbitu does not necessarily mean bi'ur, to destroy or get rid of the chametz, but rather tashbitu is davarim shebelev, something that you can do in the heart. And therefore Rashi says, bitul ba'al masagi means something that you can do in your heart and you can take care of it. Tosfot says, I don't understand that. I don't understand where this idea of tashbitu not being to destroy the chametz comes from. Because tshbata means havara, means to eliminate or destroy. Velo bitul. And it does not mean to be mevatel. Rashi says the word tashbitu teaches us about bitul. And from tashbitu we know that you can do bitul belev. Tosfot says, I don't see that. The word tashbitu, and we're going to see this later in the Gemara, means havara, means to destroy it or get rid of it. And if that's the case, what does that have to do with belev? That's an action. That's something you have to do actively. So therefore you have here a machlok between Rashi and Tosafot about the nature of bitul. Rashi says bitul derives from the word tashbitu, and it can be done belev. It's something that's done in the heart, because tashbitu is a requirement that you eliminate it from your possession, but not physically, but that you eliminate it in your mind or in your heart. Tosafot says that's not the case. The word tashbitu means havara, to eliminate it, and eliminate it means physically. Now, what does that mean in terms of bitul? Bitul functions, as Tosafot says, like hefker. It's like disowning an object. And you can disown chametz. And disowning the chametz accomplishes the same thing as doing havara, of eliminating it or burning it from your possession. So Tosafot says it works mishum hefker. The big problem with Tosafot, and he himself acknowledges it here, is that hefker has rules. Hefker has rules that, first of all, sometimes you need a recipient on the other side. It remains in your possession until the other one takes it. Or the possibility that hefker requires to be done in front of three people or in front of a beit din. There are all certain rules with regards to how hefker works. And none of those rules apply. When we do bitul, we don't do it like a regular form of hefker. The Ron again here jumps in and comes up with a compromised position where he mentions that hefker really works partly like Rashi says and partly like Tosafot says. A bitul really works mishum hefker, like Tosafot says, but it's a different type of hefker. As opposed to hefker where you're trying to disown something, where you're trying to take it out of your possession and it's in your possession, the only way you can do it is through the proper channels or the proper ways to do hefker that are laid out in the Gemara and other places. Over here, the chametz is going to leave your possession anyway. The Torah is going to basically say that you don't own the chametz, and we'll see that later on in the Gemara on Daf Vav, that the Torah takes it out of your possession. Your hefker over here is not doing something from scratch and trying to take it out of your possession, but rather that your hefker over here is basically acquiescing to what the Torah is going to do. You are preempting the Torah and saying, I know the Torah is going to take it out of my possession, and that's what I want to happen. I want the chametz to leave my possession. And in doing so, you can do hefker even without all the trappings of a normal type of halachic hefker. And because of that, that's why here, bitul works mishum hefker, not the regular type of hefker, but a unique type of hefker that acquiesces to that which is being said. The Ron has a similar understanding of kiddushin in the Gemara in Nidarim, which he espouses there, that the woman's acceptance of the kiddushim is not really any activity, but simply allowing herself to be niknate by the husband. And so similarly over here, the Ron says that this hefker is just a agreeing to have whatever is supposed to happen, happen. That's why it works mishum hefker, but does not have all the trappings of hefker. Okay, now the Gemara continues. Yibaylu, amaskir bayda chaviro b'chazkat baduk. Person who rents a house to his friend with the assumption or the agreement that it's going to be checked. Umatza'o shenu baduk. And then the socher comes and finds that it wasn't checked. Mao, what's the din? Mi havi mekach ta'ut? Does that undermine the deal? Meaning that this is something that's so significant to the deal that if it wasn't accomplished, then we say that this is a breach of contract, and he can reject or not accept the rental. Although, or maybe it's not significant enough. Tashma. It's clear that in a city where they don't pay people to check their houses, a person wants the opportunity to do a mitzvah. So even though he had agreed that he would rent it to him and it would be checked, even if it's not checked, he feels that's great, because now he gets to do the mitzvah. So why would he give up a chance to do a mitzvah? But Ella, filu ba'atru, daive agro, badgu, even a place where they pay people to do the bedikah, We're going to say, Denechle Lincha, the Gumi Mitzvah Mimona, a person wants to expend his money in order to accomplish a mitzvah. So the underlying assumption here is of the human nature. Human nature is that, number one, they want to do mitzvot. Number two is, human nature is that they want to use their money to do mitzvot. So because of that human nature, we assume here that in both cases, if the maskir didn't live up to his part of the contract to have the house be baduk, to be checked, then we still say that the contract stays and it's not considered to be a breach of contract. And based on that, we say it goes through and he can't walk away from it. And as Rashi says over here, if he's walking away from it, it's because he found a better place to rent. And not because of this issue. He's using this issue as a means to get rid of it. Now, I would just say, just remember that Bidika today is very different than Bidika in their day. We're talking about houses that at most had one room or two rooms to them. And Bidika was not as a significant undertaking as it is today. As significant as it was in their day, because they kept chametz and they hid it in the corners, they put it all over the place. Nevertheless, it was not the type of undertaking that it is today when you have to check a house that's multiple rooms all over the place. Bidika can be much more extensive today. So keeping that in mind, then a person would want to do the mitzvah bidika because it's a little bit of undertaking, gets a chance to do a mitzvah, or he would expend the money to have someone do the mitzvah. So based on that, we say that it's not considered to be a breach of contract if he doesn't live up to the fact that he was supposed to give it to him, baduk. This actually has nafkamina d'alocha, for instance, one thing like talit and tefillin. If you walk into a shul, and the shul is empty, there's nobody there, but you know that people leave their talit and tefillin there. Can you go and put on someone else's talit and tefillin in order to be yotzei, the mitzvah of talit and tefillin, to daven there? Even though nobody's present, they didn't give you permission. Here we invoke the principle, alocha, which is nechle l'inche, that people would like people to do mitzvot with their money. So you would be more than willing or more than happy to have the person use your talit and tefillin to accomplish the mitzvah. So we do say to the person he can do that. He's allowed to use your talit and tefillin to accomplish the mitzvah because we assume that a person wants that. That's exactly what he wants to happen with his possessions, to have some other people keep the mitzvah. There are conditions to that. Number one condition is that you take care of them. You have to take care of them perfectly and keep them in perfect condition. If you do damage to them, it's certainly not the case. And number two is you have to return them exactly the way you found them. You have to fold them up, wrap them up, and put them back exactly the way that you found them in order that it's no inconvenience to the other individual. In that instance, we will say yes, that you can go do it, and we invoke this principle of nechle l'inche, that people would like their money to be used or their possession to be used to accomplish a mitzvah. So there's one of the nafkaminot from what we're just saying over here, the halacha. Okay, now we move on to the next sugya. Tan hatam. We have a mishnah. Even though the mishnah is further on in the parak, the gemara still says tan hatam. We have a mishnah over there. Over there, meaning further on in the parak. You can eat for the entire fifth hour. So and you burn it in the beginning of the sixth hour. This is the way that we pass in the halacha, that we eat it for the fourth hour. Tolin kol chamesh, you have this no man's land in the fifth hour where you can't eat it, but you're not burning it. V'sofim b'techilat sheish, and then you burn it at the beginning of the sixth hour. Tekulei alma, mi'o chametz m'sheish ha'od l'malo asur. Everybody agrees here, from the sixth hour and onward, it's problematic. Mi nolan, where is this coming from? Where is this idea that you have an Isur chametz on Erev Pesach come from? We know that the Torah says you can't have chametz during Pesach. But where all of a sudden do we have this idea that you also can't have chametz in your possession on Erev Pesach? Because Rashi says over here that you'll be in violation of Bal Yireya or Bal Yimatzei. And number two is you'll be in violation of Achilat Chametz, even from the midday on the Erev Pesach. How do we know this? Where do we get this information from? So Amar Abayi, Terei Garei Tivei. You have two psukim that are contradictory. It says that you may not find so'or in your house for 7 days. Uchtiv, and also says, but on the first day, you have to remove the so'or from your house. Hakeitzad, how is that possible? So Rashi says, there's a stira here. If it says that for 7 days, you may not have so'or in your house, and then you're asking the person to do tashbitu beginning on the first day, that means that prior to tashbitu, it was mutar. If it's mutar prior to tashbitu, that means that there's a portion of the 7 days that it's mutar. Underlying Rashi's assumption is that tashbitu is what creates the isur and the heter. If I tell you to be mashbitit, that means that it's asur from there forward. Before that point, it wasn't asur. So based on that, Rashi says, I have a stira here. If you tell me to do tashbitu on the first day, that means prior to that it was mutar. And that is incongruous with the fact that it's 7 days you cannot have soar in your house. Tosafot rejects that understanding of Rashi and says, why do you have to say that? Why is it impossible that it's asur for 7 days? And there's a requirement to mashbit it when you enter into the seventh day. As soon as you enter the seventh day, you have to get rid of it. But that's not what generates the isur. The isur is bayireya, bayimatzeh. You can't have chametz in your possession. So because you can't have it in possession, then for a tashbitu, you do in the beginning. This relates back to what I said in the introduction to the Masechta, which is what drives over here. Very Rashi, tashbitu is the driver for bayireya, bayimatzeh. But then Tosafot sees it the other way around. Ba'yireo ba'metzei is what drives the fact that you need to do tashbitu. It might also relate to their different understandings of what exactly or how exactly tashbitu works. But rather, Tosafot says over here, the reason that the Gemara says is v'yitura dekra. Why do I need this extra pasuk? Say, ach, v'yom ha'rishon. What's all this extra information about it being due tashbitu? I would have done tashbitu anyway coming into the 7 days because I have to get rid of the chametz. So what's this extra lashon of ach b'yom harishon tashbitu? Okay, it said, how do I resolve this? There are both, arbasa the biur, that comes to teach us that even on the 14th already, you have to get rid of chametz. So that comes to teach us that even on the 14th, there's a restriction from tashbitu, according to Tosafot, because b'yire b'yometzei now extends on to Erev Pesach, and therefore tashbitu is also then, you do the elimination of the chametz then. According to Rashi, since tashbitu is on Erev Pesach, now the Easter starts over there. V'eimah the rabot lele chamisha asar the biur. Why don't we say it comes to include the night of the 15th for biur? The salkadat chamina, because I would have thought yamim ktiv. It says shivat yamim, during the days. So you would have thought it only begins from the daytime on the 15th. Yamim in lele, no, but not nighttime. Gamash malan afilo lelot. So achva yom rishon comes to teach us even at nighttime. How low eats trichalei? We don't need that. Da'id kish ashbatat seor la'achilat chametz. Because there's a hekesh, there is a connection between the elimination of seor and the eating of chametz. V'achilat chametz l'achilat matzah. And the eating of chametz is connected to the eating of matzah. Hashbatat seor l'achilat chametz, the connection between elimination of seor and the eating of chametz is dechtev. Shibat yamim seor lo yimatzei bebatechem. For 7 days you cannot have seor in your house. Ki kol ochel machmetz v'nechruta. Anybody who eats chametz will get a chiyuv karet. So you see a connection between the 7 days of seor not being in your possession to someone who eats chametz, gets karet. V'achilat chametz l'achilat matzah. The connection between chametz and matzah, which is a very important connection, will come up numerous times in the Masechta, which is dichtiv. B'chom ha'chametz lo tuchelo, b'chom ha'shvatichem tuchlu matzot. You may not consume chametz, and in all of your dwellings, you must eat matzot. So you see that you have a connection between matzah and chametz. Uchtibe b'matzah, and the pasuk says, b'matzah berev tuchlu matzot. At the evening, you must eat matzot. So you have to eat matzot at nighttime. Now, be'erev, if you look in the psukim there, the Gemara takes the Be'erev Tochlu Matzot, there is an obligation to eat on the night, Matzot. That's not clear from the Pasuk. If you look in the Pasuk itself, it basically tells you that the obligation or the necessity to eat Matzot starts at the night of the 15th and goes to the night of the 21st. It's not telling you there's an obligation, it's giving you a description of a time period. But given that, the time period starts from nighttime. So if the time period for eating Matzot starts at nighttime, the Hekesh to Chametz tells me it also applies to Chametz. Achilat Chametz applies even from the nighttime. If it applies to Achilat Chametz, we have a connection between Achilat Chametz and the elimination of Seor. And so, just like by Chametz, the Easter starts at night, so too, the necessity to eliminate the Seor is also, or the issue of Bali Re'a Bali Matzeh applies even at nighttime. So since I know that already from the Psukim, the Ach Bayom Rishon can't teach me that information. So Ach Bayom Rishon must be teaching me something else. That something else is that even on the 14th, there is an Isur or an obligation to remove the chametz from your possession. Where it says, Ve'ema, the Rabot Leil Yudal de Biur. So why don't we say that it's the whole day of the 14th that's problematic? Where it says, Bayom Ktiv. It says, Bayom, Ach Bayom Rishon. Bayom. So Bayom means during the daytime. Ve'ema Mitzafro. So why don't we say that it should start in the morning? If it's biyom, it should start in the morning. Ach chilek. Because the word ach comes and divides it up. So Rashi brings two interpretations of why ach chilek. We have a principle that we saw before that achim v'rakim miyutim. Ach v'rak in the Torah is always something that is a miyut. Alma miksa de yom mutar, umiksa de asur. So see that part of the day is mutar and part of the day is asur. This is based on Rashi, the Shita Tov, that the mitzvah of Teshbitu determines when the Easter starts. So now if you tell me that the ach tells me that some is mutar, some is asur, that means because whenever Teshbitu happens, that determines when the Easter of Chametz comes in. So if I tell you, ach, and that Teshbitu only applies to half the day, then so too, Bayire, Bayimatzeh is only going to apply to half the day. Rashi brings a second interpretation, which is that the gematria, or the exchange of the letters of ach, is to chetz. And then he uses a type of exchange, or letter exchange, that exchanges, you see in Rashi, the aleph, chet, samech, that every seventh letter has a connection together. So every seventh letter, if you put them together, will end up with a letter that you can exchange it for. So if I take the word ach, then it's aleph, chet, and samach, you can exchange it for, so exchange it for a chet. And then the chaf can be exchanged for dalet, chaf, and tzadi, so exchange the chaf for a tzadi, so you get chetz. Chetz means chetzi, half. And from that, that's how we know that half the day is considered to be asur, and half the day is considered to be mutar. And Tosafot obviously favors that second interpretation of Rashi, because Tosafot doesn't see tashbitu as being the driver of the isur b'yire b'yimatzeh. But rather, he sees that Bayur Matzeh is the cause for Tashbitu. And therefore, he says, the Ach here is going to teach us that there's an Isur of Chametz on the second half of the day. And since there's an Isur on the second half of the day, therefore you have to do Tashbitu. And that's why he says, ach, here means chetzi. Chetzi of the day is asur, therefore do tashbitu. Okay, we'll stop over here.